All right, so today, part 10 in the series on dukkha or core stress. We may end it today, and any discussion of Adi Shankara, who's a very important figure, as the who's sometimes called the founder of Advaita Vedanta or non-dual Vedanta. Perhaps I'll save for another series or a shorter series, shorter set of couple of talks on his philosophy and his teaching and how that interrelates to Buddhism and how it's useful to fill out our understanding of the goal and the path. But today, I want to perhaps end the series where Gautama started his work or ministry or teaching career. From a sutta, perhaps one of the most famous suttas in Buddhism, called Dhammacakka Pavattana. Dhamma means the law or the truth or the Buddha, the essential teachings. Chakka is wheel, Pavattana is setting into motion. So it's called setting the wheel of Dhamma, the Dhamma wheel in motion. This was from Samyutta Nikaya 56, 11. Translated here in this case by Thanissaro Bhikkhu and there are other translations, and it's a very important sutta in the setting down the foundations of all of the Buddha Dhamma or Buddhist teachings that came subsequent to it until Gautama's death. And he basically kept elaborating on the elements of this teaching given here in Dhammacakkappavattana. This was given at Sarnath. Sarnath is north of Varanasi, which used to be called Benares. And I'll send you a couple of links on Sarnath. Northern India. Benares at that time, now called Varanasi, is the famous city for all Hindus, where the devout have their corpse burned by the Ganges and the ashes spread into the water. And let me just read a little bit just to get a sense of the situation here. Sarnath from the Wikipedia page. Sarnath is a place located 10 kilometers northeast of Varanasi, also called Benares in the old days. Near the confluence of the Ganges and the Varuna rivers in Uttar Pradesh, Uttar Pradesh, very poor part of northern India. The deer park, it was also a deer park, is where Gautama first taught the Dharma. The Sangha came into existence through the enlightenment of Khandanya, which is Khandanya, who was one of the one of his previous teachers, I believe. It's also called Isipatana. And there's another place in India that is very old called Patna, Patna, different, but Isipatna, city mentioned by Gautama as one of the four places of pilgrimage. And again, this is where the Four Noble Truths were first taught, and that's what we're going to look into. An origin of names. It also was called Deer Park, as I said, and is considered the place where holy men landed. Isi, or in Sanskrit it's called Rishi, like Rishikesh. Rishikesh in the north is a very serious city, town near the Himalayas for yogis and teachers. I think the Buddha, the Beatles went to Rishikesh. And there's an interesting legend here. The legend, this is from Wikipedia, the legend says that when the Buddha to be was born, which was not here, was in a different part of northern India, some devas came down to announce it to 500 rishis, 500 sages in India. The rishis all rose into the air and disappeared, and their relics fell to the ground. Here in Isipatna, near in Sarnath, Another explanation for the name is that Ishipatna was so called because sages, on their way through the air from the Himalayas, alight here or start from here on their aerial flight. So it's a serious what transfer point for rishis flying through northern India to and from the Himalayas. The story goes on, Pacheka Buddhas, meaning those who became fully enlightened by their own efforts, not hearing a Buddha, but becoming Buddhas by their own effort, basically doing solitary practice in a time when there wasn't a Buddha in the world, particularly. Having spent 7 days in contemplation in the Gandhamadana, I'm not sure what that is, bathe in a lake here, Anatapta Lake, and come to the habitations of men through the air, again, in search of alms, they descend to earth at Isipatna. So Isipatna, or Sarnath, where Gautama gave this first teaching, seems to be an important airport or way station for rishis and Pacheka Buddhas and sages who are flying to and from the Himalayas. Very, very interesting. And then there's a story. Sometimes Pacheka Buddhas come to Isipatna from Nandamulaka Pabara, which I think is another non-physical dimension. So it's an important site in the history of Buddhism, as well as in the transiting or movement of sages magically through northern India through the air. So that's kind of interesting. By the way, there's a lot of static, so anybody want to unmute and remute, that might be helpful. Yeah, that helps. So, let me start with the Dhammacakkappavattana. And here, what we're going to find is all of the essential teachings prefigured or encapsulated, much of what we've been looking into in the last 10 weeks. In terms of the nature of dukkha, the cause of dukkha, or stress, suffering, pain, distress, craving, tanha, clinging, upadana, how it is that we bind ourself by various forms of attachment, how the conceit of self or mistaken notions of self drive us to get into trouble. And if I want to brush my teeth, it's not the same thing as having a craving for sensual pleasure. If I want to eat my lunch, it's not exactly the same as what could be called grasping, clinging, and a cause of suffering. Meaning, there's a lot that is required for the maintenance of human life that could certainly be associated with desire and aversion, meaning I want to put my clothes on in the morning rather than walk around naked or dirty. I want to wash. I don't want to be unwashed. I want to eat. I don't want to be hungry. Which doesn't necessarily rise to the level of being, I think, associated with clinging or clinging and craving. Meaning, it's not necessarily a precursor to bondage and forced demand, forced reincarnation, because that's really what Gautama's teaching is all about: is how to cut away the roots of attachment that are self-binding, not only to patterns of thought and action and speech that create more suffering, but also long-term reincarnation beyond what is needed to move through the path, move through the dimensions. And so much unpacking would be needed to see how we ourselves are make trouble for ourselves in the ways that are relevant to craving and clinging and attachment, and then binding ourselves and making more suffering. basically, whatever is to our long-term welfare and benefit is good to do. Whatever is to our long-term harm or restriction or limitation is ultimately not good to do. Meanwhile, we do both, and we may not know which is which, and we have all these desires and we have natural aversions. The key, I think, is a commitment to self-understanding, a commitment to honest observation, a commitment to accepting what is, which includes what I'm happy to admit and what I hate to admit, what I'm happy to see, what I'm very unhappy to see, and then working with that by understanding its causes, the causes of our patterns, without blame. Without blame equals forgiveness, right? So the healing cycle, beginning with honest observation and a willingness to accept my feeling and accept the truth of what it is that's causing this feeling, and take fair responsibility for being the author of our mind and our life conditions. And that goes very deep, of course. Certainly, when we include pre-programmed catalysts, Ra talking about making choices before birth, which include the choices of a whole lot of challenging catalysts or difficulties that we meet with people around and family, or body illnesses and conditions. Fairly taking responsibility for our authorship of our life, of our mind, of our body, of relationships, of all that is karmically deserved or karmically just, without blame, which includes then forgiveness and deeper understanding. That includes the work of freeing ourselves from unnecessary craving and clinging. And though we're not monks in this lifetime, and we're not gunning for a complete and perfect awakening, knowing the Four Noble Truths, which is basically the nature of suffering and its cause, the nature of freedom from suffering and its cause, that there is a problem here called stress or dukkha, sometimes called suffering. Suffering as a very subtle matter too, right? The nature of the problem or the challenge we face existentially and its cause, the nature of the reality of a freedom from that problem and its cause, which is the way to nirvana, complete and perfect enlightenment. Knowing that, applying it in our own ways to our own lives, in which we are willing to hold, to keep wanting certain desires rather than wanting to be free of all desire, is a very delicate matter and very honest. Like, no, I don't want to be free of all desire. There are certain desires and things that I really want. I have certain aversions and certain patterns that I'm not willing to dismantle yet. Fine, fine. Yet we can continually dismantle the unneeded or see how we create trouble for ourselves and bring love, wisdom to the roots to heal and release what's unneeded. So let's jump in to the sutta here. Tanisaro's translation. I have heard, or thus have I heard, that on one occasion, so this was again a monk later speaking his memory of this original teaching that was then recorded on the palm leaves in Pali language that became, you know, the sutta for the Tripitaka or the Buddhist doctrine. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying at Varanasi in the game refuge at Isipatna. There he addressed the group of five monks. Just a second, I want to pause. Hold on. Continuing after the dissipation of the white noise. So, thus have I heard, that on one occasion the Blessed One Gautama was staying at Varanasi, which is really Sarnath, in the game refuge at Isipatna. Again, that's actually Sarnath, near Varanasi or Benares, There he addressed the group of five monks. These were not yet Buddhists. They were those that he studied with prior. Quote, Gautama says, "There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth," meaning become a monk or become a yogi. "Which two?" not to be indulged in, to be avoided. "That," the first, "that which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects, base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable, and that which is devoted to self-affliction, painful, ignoble, unprofitable. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata," the thus come one, or Buddha's referring to himself, "producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm." The middle way leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. That's Nibbana. "And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata? That, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding," meaning what is this middle way? "Precisely this Noble Eightfold Path." So now we're talking straight up to the third and fourth Noble Truths, meaning that there is a freedom from the condition of dukkha, and there is a path to that freedom from dukkha. What is this middle way realized by the Tathagata? Producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. What is it? Precisely this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. And these eight constituents of the way to nirvana or complete unbinding are divided into the three, Shila, Samadhi, Prajna. Shila meaning virtue, ethics, morality, which is really right speech, right action, right livelihood. And then Samadhi and Prajna, which are the other five. particularly in where right view and right resolve precede, or there's a little discrepancy on how those two relate to the later two. You know, these other elements of the Noble Eightfold Path relate to the second three of Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, where Samadhi is basically meditative work and Prajna is the wisdom, discernment, awakening fruit of the meditative work. Also called insight, like insight meditation. Surely, right view and right resolve is the basis of doing practice samadhi that leads to awakening or freedom. And so it's very much bound up with right effort and right mindfulness and right concentration, both in meditation and as the way leading to awakening. Again, those eight elements, the eight samas, I talked about this long, long ago, where samadhiti, sama, right view, is the first, and that's the purpose of all our study, to get right view, or a true understanding of the true understanding of what is Buddha Dhamma, what is this Buddha's teaching, and then applying it to ourselves, however we might. But the eight, you know, it takes years to really deeply know this stuff, and it never ends. And so don't worry if it seems like there are the three of this and the five of that and the eight of that and the ten over there, the three and the eight and the five and the 12 and going on and on. Don't worry. Take it as much as you want. But it's good stuff. But these eight can be understood in the three, particularly Shila, Samadhi, Prajna, where the morality of how we live, particularly right speech, right action, right livelihood, which is basically do no harm and live with love, wisdom. More and more focus on green, blue, love, wisdom, or acceptance and honesty, kindliness and truthfulness. That's the way to Shila. or morality, virtue, ethics, and or that's the basis, and that supports us in meditation as much as we wish to do, then we have a peaceful heart, rather than a lot of guilt and shame. Then we get to the first noble truth. Now, monks, this is the noble truth of stress, or dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is stressful or dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates, meaning upadana skanda, meaning our clinging to these constituents of the sense of self, are all dukkha, stressful. And so, here comes white noise. I've gone over this lots and lots of times. Body, sensations, perception, the mental process of thinking and feeling and imagining and interpreting, and even consciousness itself is considered stressful. And you can see how this is really not Hinduism. Clearly, it's way, 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 way far from the Abrahamic Middle Eastern religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We're not talking about love God, do God's will, submit to God's will, get punished, go to hell, go to heaven forever. We're talking about mind training. We're talking about a deeply psycho-spiritual teaching. This is not deistic, God-oriented religion. Gautama said, I'm a man, and what I've done, you can do too. And man, women, anyone can do it if one puts in the ingredients. Anyone who learns how to cook can be an excellent cook and make a delicious meal. Anyone who comprehends this teaching deeply and puts it to practice will achieve complete and perfect awakening too. And it has nothing to do with the logos, or it's not a matter of worship the logos and follow our beliefs and dogmas. Not at all. There are some good to religion, to Abrahamic religions, but this is really a different situation. Going on, so in short, the five clinging aggregates, our experience of mind and body is dukkha, even when there's sukha, or happiness, or pleasure, because it's impermanent. It comes, it goes. And even if you try to hold it, you find you can't find it. You can't isolate it and identify it and grasp it, because it's insubstantial as well as impermanent. This is a, critical, critical understanding or teaching that we need to apply, even though we're going to maintain some desires. Okay, so what is the noble truth of dukkha? Well, all of these aspects of the life process and longing and losing, having and letting go, or getting and losing, having and longing, as well as even the moments of joy, there is some stress there too. Then we go to the second noble truth, and this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination or cause of stress or dukkha, the craving, tanha, the craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there, i.e., tanha, craving for sensual pleasure, meaning kama, the ways of kamaloka, craving for becoming, which is craving for changed mental, emotional experience, and craving for non-becoming, tanha, associated with seeking to have nothing, to self-annihilate, to annihilate experience or change in a confused way. So any kind of craving, tanha, leading to clinging, upadana, right? So craving as the essential basis of dukkha, and that craving leads to our behavior of clinging or grasping, aversion, ignorance, right? Holding on and reaching out to get and hold, pulling away and pushing off and keeping out, keeping something away and off, aversion and ignorance, basic mind foggy, not knowing. That's all stressful, and that is clinging, and that's associated with all of that which we call ourselves, and that comes out of tanha, or these basic cravings. And that craving as the origin of dukkha, leading to dukkha, stress, which is all associated with clinging, or upadana. Then the third. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of stress, the end of dukkha. The remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, similar to vairagya, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very tanha, very craving. So getting rid of the end of dukkha is the end of tanha. The end of stress is the end of craving. Because the end of craving, these basically triloka, three loka, three realms, seven dimensions, versions of craving or hungering, thirsting, tanha, leads to the various types of clinging in the seven dimensions, meaning grasping, aversion, ignorance, or desiring and hating, associated with our dimensional experience, in the ways of these three types of craving for sensual or physical, experience, pleasures, happiness, well-being, and then those of becoming and the non-becoming, which relates to higher dimensional life, rupa loka, arupa loka. If you remember what that's all about, the higher dimensions of Buddhist cosmology. And so the nature of dukkha is upadana skanda, attachment, grasping, aversion, ignorance associated with all that we consider ourselves. The cause of that suffering or stress is the basis for the clinging, or the basis of upadana, which is tanha, or craving, or thirst, or hunger. Some basic sense, there's a problem here, I better do something. I better change my present moment experience because this is bad, and then that'll be good, and I want the good, and I hate the bad. And so dukkha is upadana skanda, the clinging associated with all that we consider ourselves, mind, body, spirit. That's dukkha. And its cause is the cause of upadana or clinging, which is tanha or craving. And the letting go of dukkha, or the freedom from dukkha or stress, is the freedom from craving, therefore a freedom from clinging, even if one incarnates in the octave, like a Buddha or the Guardians or Nityananda or somebody like that. So, dukkha is in many ways associated with the reality that we're clinging to various aspects of identity and subjective experience in a universe or in a seven-dimensional octave in which everything is impermanent and insubstantial. That's kind of stressful, to be seeking to secure a permanent happiness, a permanent freedom from pain, a permanent continuance of well-being in a seven-dimensional octave or situation where nothing is permanent. Everything's impermanent, and nothing is really even substantial. It's all anatta, insubstantial, or sunya, empty. That's kind of stressful. And yet that comes out of a deeper mind craving, which is really a craving for dimensional experience of the triloka, of kamaloka, rupaloka, aroopaloka, condition associated with the craving for the very nature of the experience in these in the seven realms, but particularly the human third density, kamaloka, craving for sensual pleasure, or craving for embodiment, craving to have a body. Some being, many beings in astral planes are longing to have a body. I want a body. I want to have my own body for myself, a flesh body for experience. There is something like that, you know. And then there's that craving that leads to the hunger to stay in higher dimensional life, which is Rupa Loka, Arupa Loka, fourth and fifth, and then sixth and seventh densities. This is a very interesting connection, a combination or integration of raw material cosmology and Buddha Dhamma cosmology. You won't find it anywhere else, but I recommend the elders of the Confederation to take notes or continue note-taking. I don't think it's new. So then, the nature of stress or dukkha is clinging and attachment associated with all that we consider ourselves. Its cause is the very hunger and thirst for dimensional experience, starting with the human fleshy, going on to fourth and fifth rupa, and sixth and seventh dimensional arupa, formlessness. Beings are in those dimensions because they want to be, and they get out because they want to be. Then, the fourth noble truth, and this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation, actually the third, the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very tanha or craving. Okay, so letting go of the craving releases the clinging and eventually puts an end to the suffering or stress or dukkha. Then the fourth noble truth. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice. And so the Eightfold Path is a practice path or a delineation of the practice of the spiritual path. And this is the case for everybody, whether they are religious or not, agnostic or not, Mohammedan, Jewish, Christian, Hindu, animist, indigenous, or not. The idea here is there is a path of seven chakra mind body spirit development. One either knows that or doesn't. When one knows that, one either seeks to know it well and makes effort to continue seeking to know it well or not. Or one who seeks to know it does make some effort, and that effort grows over time, over multiple incarnations, and leads to clarification of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha, or to complete and perfect enlightenment, or to the end of soul evolution out of the octave. And the way of practice leading to the end of dukkha, which is, the end of craving and the end of clinging and the end of dimensional incarnation, seven dimensional, is the Eightfold Path, right view, right resolve, which again, I think, while they could be, some people will associate them with prajna, the last of the three, sila, samadhi, prajna, wisdom, discernment, insight. In practical terms, you really have to start with right view and right resolve to even develop sila or virtue, which is right speech, right action, right livelihood. To even know that we should restrain our desires sometimes, and that harmlessness is good for me too. Not only good for you, it's also good for me. And it's in fact even better for me than it is good for you that I restrain my desires associated with action and speech and livelihood so as to do no harm. Because if I do harm to other, I'm doing harm to self, right? Self and other is one, right? Self and other self. So, yet to know even that that's important requires a right view, right resolve, like the view of karma and reincarnation, and the resolve that I don't want to make more trouble for myself. I really, really want to help myself. What else? Well, you want to hurt yourself? And so that means not making trouble to others too. And right view develops over time, and we need some resolve or determination even to continue developing right view. Yet there's a interplay and feedback as right view grows, or our understanding of self and path and reality grows, so too does our resolve to keep going. So the greatest teacher of meditation is meditation. Your practice is the greatest teacher. Self-training is the teacher. And then we get some sense that Sheila is good for you and me. It isn't just good for the other, who I try to hope not to harm, but it's good for the so-called self that appreciates ahimsa or do no harm. Then indeed one can go deeper in meditation. Then indeed one can know what right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration is in samadhi, leading to awakening, which gives us an even greater right view and an even greater right resolve or resolve, true view, true resolve, seeing clearly and increasingly committed to continuing to see clearly and keep going, comes as one of the fruits of meditation before the final fruit. So Gautama, having laid out these four noble truths, dukkha in its nature, being upadana skanda, the clinging associated with all the sense of self, and its cause being tanha, or craving, and its ending, which is called nirvana, or nibbana, or the ending of stress, the ending of craving, and then that there's a way of practice leading to that end of dukkha, end of craving, end of dimensional rebirth, samsara, being the Eightfold Path or the training of Sila Samadhi and Prajna, actually. Having explained all that, then Gautama explains his process and says, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of stress, or dukkha. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose, and all of that within me with regard to things never heard before, which is then the second noble truth of dukkha, is to be comprehended. Meaning, he came to vision and insight and discernment and understanding and knowing and seeing the first noble truth of dukkha. And then he came to that awareness and insight about the comprehending of that truth. So first, there is this, that there is a truth to stress, or our ontological existential condition can be understood not only, but essentially as one of stress, because of all the stress that's associated with clinging to all the constituents of the sense of self, body, mind. So he came to recognize the reality of the dukkha or stress associated with all clinging to all body, mind, self, identity related experience. Then he came to realize that he was comprehending that. Then he came to realize this noble truth of dukkha has been comprehended. And that's the same with the other noble truths. He's explaining in a very impersonal, objective, dissociative way. Psychologists might not like this. Vision arose, insight arose, and some people who get to spiritual bypass get to this, what I call the erased, the presumably erased self-image, like Karen Horney talks about three types of distorted self-image or self-esteem. Buddhists may do that and have sense, I have no self, I am no self, I have no experience, I have no problem, I'm clear. And this kind of language unfortunately supports that, but you can pretend, but you know better, as do all those with eyes to see. So Gautama's explaining then, vision arose, insight, discernment, knowledge, or illumination within him, regard to various things never heard before, meaning he didn't hear, nobody taught him these four noble truths. It came to him by his insight, by his practice. What also came to him is the other three noble truths. The origination of dukkha, meaning the cause or its origin being tanha, craving for dimensional experience. Then, the truth that one can be free of dukkha. The origination of stress is to be abandoned and then has been abandoned. So he's basically going through a process where by his own practice, insight to the nature of these Four Noble Truths is arising spontaneously, and comprehension or awareness that he's comprehended each one is arising also. So it's not like, oh, I'm Mr. Gautama looking at this thing, wow, I'm great. But, oh, I see this is, and I see that I'm seeing. I see it is, and now I know seeing is happening and comprehension is happening. And so vision and insight, discernment and knowledge, illumination regarding the ending of dukkha, and that the noble truth, and this is another, there is a subtle distinction regarding the experience of vision, insight, discernment, knowledge, illumination of the Four Noble Truths for Gautama. It's not simply a recognition, or for each of the four, there was a recognition. This is the noble truth of stress, the truth of the origin of stress or dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha. Not only did he see that, he also realized that each one needs to be, he could see how to relate ideally to each, meaning the noble truth of dukkha is to be comprehended, and then he got it, he comprehended it. The noble truth of the origin of stress is that the origin is to be abandoned. The cause of dukkha is to be abandoned, meaning I see craving is the root of dukkha. Now I see craving has been abandoned. The noble truth of the origination of dukkha has been abandoned. So the first noble truth of dukkha is to be comprehended. The second noble truth of an origin of dukkha is to be abandoned. It's basically an abandoning of the origin, or the continued creating of dukkha. The third noble truth of cessation, end of stress, is to be directly experienced, and then was directly experienced. So he's realizing each of the four truths, and as he realizes each, before he moves on to the next, I assume, he's not only acknowledging, recognizing that this truth exists, the truth of there being dukkha as the basis for experience, really, or clinging, really, it's a clinging, self-oriented clinging experience of all sorts, in all dimensions, is dukkha, and then that it has a cause, and that's called craving, and that it has an end, and that's called nirvana, or complete perfect enlightenment, unbinding, and that there's a way to that, called the path. He's recognizing each one, then he's recognizing that each one needs to be met a certain way. Meaning, the first truth of dukkha needs to be comprehended, and then he notices, recognizes it's been comprehended. This is the truth of dukkha, it needs to be comprehended. Ah, comprehension has occurred. The noble truth of its cause or origination being tana, that it's not that the truth needs to be abandoned, but participation in the causing of dukkha stress needs to be ended. So the continued originating or causing stress needs to be abandoned, and then he recognizes, okay, it's now been abandoned. Pretty darn impersonal here. Then the third, the noble truth of the cessation or ending of stress or ending of dukkha, the ending of avidya, actually, the ending of any self-binding to dimensional experience, that unbinding needs to be experienced, directly experienced, and then he recognizes, okay, this noble truth of cessation of dukkha has now been directly experienced. That's gnosis, but it's not just a gnosis of a mind knowing. It's a full being experience. Then the fourth, the noble truth of the way of practice, leading to the end of dukkha or the end of stress or nirvana. He's realizing that noble truth, the path, needs to be developed. And then he recognizes, okay, now noble truth of the way of practice leading to cessation of dukkha has now been developed. So the reality of dukkha needs to be comprehended. The continued originating, causing, fermenting, making of stress needs to be abandoned. The reality of an end of stress needs to be directly experienced, and a path of practice, a way leading to the direct experience of the end of suffering, needs to be developed. And he recognized all that done by him in real time, sitting under the Bo tree in Bodh Gaya 2,500 years ago. He goes on, and monks, as long as this, my three round, which was, I think is Triloka, three realms, 12 permutation, meaning paticca-samuppada, the 12 nidanas or links in the chain of becoming and rebirth, death, you know, birth, aging, sickness and death and rebirth, all multidimensional reincarnation in all the dimensions of the octave, that's analyzed in 12 permutations. And monks, as long as this, my three realm also, 12 link or permutation, knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths as they have come to be, as long as it was not pure, I didn't claim to have directly awakened to the right self-awakening, unexcelled in the cosmos with its deities, maras and brahmas, meaning good and bad entities, higher dimensional, Orion and the Confederation, we may say, with its contemplatives and brahmins, its royalty and common folk. But as soon as this, my three-round, 12 permutation or link, knowledge and vision concerning the Four Noble Truths, as they have come to be, meaning as they are or as he's come to know them, but as soon as that knowledge and vision, meaning of his seven-dimensional, three-round means three-realm, or round in samsara in the Triloka, three realms, Kamaloka, Rupaloka, Arupaloka, the seven dimensions. His knowledge and vision regarding the step-by-step causal sequence associated with incarnation in all the seven dimensions. Until that knowledge and vision was truly pure, before it was, he knew it wasn't. When it was, he knew it was. So he's basically saying, like, I know everything. I know all the constituents of the causal sequence that leads beings to be reborn in the seven dimensions of this octave, in the Buddhist cosmological division of Triloka, three loka, you know, which is pretty much 3D, Kamaloka, 45D, Rupaloka, 67D, Arupaloka. That's the three triloka, three round permutation, I think he's talking about, three round field in which there is the 12 links, 12 nidanas, 12 permutations, meaning links in the chain to the causal basis for continued dimensional experiencing. When he finally had purified knowledge and vision concerning all that, then he says, I did claim to have directly awakened to the right self-awakening, unexcelled in the cosmos, right, in the octave, with its deities, maras and brahmas, contemplatives and brahmins, royalty and common folk. Knowledge and vision, and that's a common pair in Gautama talking about awakening. Knowledge and vision arose in me. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. There is now no further becoming. And that was the end of that, meaning I'm finished with becoming in Triloka. That is what the Blessed One said, gratified, the group of five monks, or ascetics, delighted at his words, and while this explanation was being given, there arose to Venerable Kodanya the dustless, stainless Dhamma eye. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation, meaning whatever it is that's born is going to fall away or cease. That, I think, may be the dustless, stainless Dhamma eye sometimes is understood as Sotapanna, but it might be that he achieved Arahant. I'm not sure. Then concluding, and when the Blessed One had set the wheel of Dhamma in motion, meaning had done Dhamma Chaka Pavatana, the earth devas, or deities, cried, non-physical, of course, the angelics, the earth angelics, cried out, at Varanasi, in the game refuge at Isipatna, the Blessed One has set in motion the unexcelled Dhammachaka that cannot be stopped by Brahman or contemplative, Deva, Mara, or God, or anyone else in the cosmos. On hearing the earth devas cry, the devas of the four kings heaven took up the cry, and then the devas of the 33, the Yama devas, Tushita devas, Nimanarati devas, Paranimita devas, Paranimita deva, Parinimita Vasavati devas, the devas of Brahma's retinue took up the cry. These are devas, which are not necessarily angelics without free will, but also higher dimensional, positively oriented beings in fourth and fifth and sixth densities, particularly, all took up the cry, at Varanasi, in the game refuge at Isipatna, the Blessed One has set in motion the unexcelled Dhammachaka that cannot be stopped by Brahman or contemplative, Deva, Mara, or God, or anyone at all in the cosmos. God is Brahman. So, or Brahma. So, in that moment, that instant, the cry shot right up to the Brahma worlds, all through the highest dimensional existences. And this 10,000-fold cosmos shivered and quivered and quaked, while a great measureless radiance appeared in the cosmos, surpassing the effulgence of the devas. Then the Blessed One exclaimed, "So you really know, Kodanya, so you really know?" And that is how Venerable Kodanya acquired the name Anya Kodanya, Kodanya who knows. Anya Kodanya, I guess Anya means knowing. So the knowing Kodanya, so it's an alliteration, Anya Kodanya. And I guess that was one of the monks who were really not monks, there was no Buddhist Sangha yet. One of the ascetics who had been his teacher got the Dhamma eye, which is either Sotapanna or a higher stage, maybe Arahant. Who knows? I don't know the details of everything. But this is the account of Gautama's first teaching, where in the most detached, impersonal language, which I think is his sincere experience or expression, sincere, authentic expression of his experience, where he was beyond identity. And this is like Ra talking about leaving sixth density, free of identity and memory. What does it mean to be free of identity? Well, it really is no longer clinging to any apparent subjective sense of an agency or an I center, a centered I, a core of experience or center point of experience is not found, is not made. It's not found because it's not made. There's no more samskara. There's no more fashioning, fermenting, concocting, mental conceiving of identity. And therefore there's no more experience of it. And there's no more experience of it, so there's no more need to conceive it. And that's the basis of this sort of radical impersonality, I think, in the language that he speaks of his successive realizations of the Four Noble Truths associated with vision and knowledge, or knowledge and vision. That's the key, is knowledge and vision and knowledge, seeing and knowing. Right? eyes and ears. Fourth chakra, fifth chakra. Hey, hey, it's the fourth chakra, fifth chakra that increasingly sees the completed development of sixth chakra. The completed development of sixth chakra is beyond seeing and knowing, beyond seeing and hearing, beyond love wisdom, beyond mind. But it's known by mind. The completed development of sixth chakra, which is all you need, because seventh, it's basically the shuttle to, the gateway to intelligent infinity, right? Seventh chakra. The full development of the gateway is the full development of the shuttle, is the completed development of spirit complex, is the complete union, ultimately energetic functional union of sixth and seventh chakras by full development of six, which is known by fourth and fifth, or leads to vision and knowledge of that. Vision and knowledge of that union of 6-7, or perfection of spirit complex, is known by seeing, by being seen. It's seen and known. And when one is there, it's painful to say me. It's painful to say me and I, actually. I feel it. Meaning I feel a dukkha with just clinging with that verbiage. That verbiage re-experiencing is subtle dukkha. Because it's a making, it's an unneeded making. Making, fabrication, samskara, fashioning is painful. Yeah, it really is. The making of what isn't is dukkha. And it comes out of deep levels of tanha, craving. And it's, you know, the essential upadana. It's the essential upadana of skanda. It's the upadana ahamkara. Ahamkara meaning making self. Self-making, the conceit of an apparent selfhood. An apparently separated, substantial selfhood. Its making is ahamkara, and that's the essential upadana, clinging, that comes out of a craving to do so, and it's very much the root of dukkha, and one can actually feel that moving, moving down to it is dukkha. If one can, I mean, who knows, right? I need a teacher to tell me where I am, but I have some sense that moving to the fashioning from a non-fashioning, from a reality of non-fashioning to a experience of the fashioning of me is dukkha, yeah, for sure. samskara is dukkha, absolutely. So anyway, this is Gautama's victory song delivered at Deer Park, Isipatna, near Varanasi, or Benares, 2,500 years ago. Very totally relevant to us today, yet, you know, we're not monks and nuns, and we take the path our own way. But surely we can increasingly see and move to release unnecessary patterns and false beliefs of self and other and way, and patterns that are self-limiting, self-binding, harmful to self and other, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood aspects. We can certainly see it more and more, and if you want to go fast, do more practice. Period. Do more study, but particularly do more practice, and make sure your technique is correct. Otherwise, you're going to go far on the wrong path or perhaps get into trouble. But if you want to go fast, more anapanasati or breath mindfulness type meditation is the fast path vehicle. It's the race car of the path. So anyway, herein ends the series on dukkha, core stress, which is another way of talking about from pain to release, actually. It's a Buddhist leading, a Buddhist-led, Buddha-Dhamma predominant, or Buddha-Dhamma-focused understanding, presentation, analysis, exploration of the path from pain to release. Pain, dukkha, release, nirvana. And there's no other tradition on earth that has done this work of this elaboration, period. None. Zero. As far as I know. Right? I mean, a lot of other traditions have a lot of important things to say. But I've never seen any of them that spell out the problem. We can talk about happiness, that's nice, but let's talk about problem. You want to have greater happiness, you might want to look at problems and resolve them. If you want greater happiness, it does help to break new ground, which means to identify and resolve all the problematic. All this problematic. It's nice to have fun. But if you want to have more fun, you might want to find out how you're not having fun and what's problematic and its cause and its resolution and do so, then you'll have more fun. And I don't see any religion, any spiritual tradition, anyone in the New Age or any other lineage in New Age, meaning spiritism, theosophy, channeling this, that, and the other channels, that articulates the problem, the path, the solution, the way, as clearly as Buddhadhamma, from early Buddhist Pali Canon, what the Theravadins are attempting to continue learning today. So it's a big deal when a Buddha appears in a world. Yes, I think that's true. The Buddha said that. I think that's quite true. It's a big deal when a Buddha appears, a way shower, an awakened one, way shower appears in the world to show the way. It's a big deal. It doesn't happen in every third density planet in every third density cycle. Nityananda is another category. He's really more of an avatara who appeared to do some planetary work and dispense miracles and then leave. He was the helper for the 20th century. He was a logoic anchor of intelligent energy. He was a pranic anchor, logoic pranic anchor for the 20th century, I'd say. Gautama was a way shower, totally different. Same development, I think, or same achievement, but different function. So, I hope this has been helpful, and it's certainly been very helpful for me to speak it. I hope you could or continue to see helpful truth and apply it to yourselves in your path in your own way. Please take good care of yourself. See you in the light in the future, wherever it may be. Take good care and good night.